Hello, everybody. This is Bill Cloud, and this is the Torah portion called Visot HaBaracha. And this is the blessing. And this is taken from Devarim, or Deuteronomy chapter 33, verse 1, through the end of Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 12. Of course, this is the last Torah portion in Deuteronomy. This is the last Torah portion, period. This particular portion describes what happened at the very last moments of Moses' life as he is preparing to go to the top of Mount Nebo and then be gathered unto his fathers. And following in the tradition established by Jacob, Moses goes from tribe to tribe to begin to bless them before he dies. And like Jacob's blessing, Moses' blessing also combines prophecy about the particular tribes with the blessings upon the tribes. And of course, before leaving the nation, Moses gives a general blessing to the entire nation, and he says to them, "There is none like unto God, O Jeshurun, who rides on the heavens as your help." Now, because this is the last Torah portion, this is the one that is read on Simchat Torah, which is the day that marks the end of Sukkot, or rejoicing in the Torah, really, is what Simchat Torah means. And that is when the annual Torah cycle is completed. And of course, on Simchat Torah, this is the day when the Sefer Torah, the Torah scroll, is rolled all the way back to the beginning. You've come to the end of the book, and now as you come to the end, you go back to the beginning, hinting that the end is the beginning is the end. And of course, that brings to mind what Scripture has to say about the end of days, specifically what it says in Revelation chapter 6, verse 14. It says, "Then the sky receded as a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place." Of course, this is describing what happens at the end of the end, just at the time of the Messianic Kingdom, when things then begin to move toward how it was in the very beginning, before the fall of man. So this Torah portion, again, is what's read on Simchat Torah, when the scroll is rolled back to the beginning. Now, in verse 1 of chapter 33, again, the Torah portion is called Visot HaBaracha, and this is the blessing. This is the blessing that Moses pronounced upon the tribes. Of course, the song that preceded this was an admonition and emphasized, really, the punishments that Israel could expect for disobedience. But the blessings describe Israel's ultimate destiny, which has been determined by the Creator, if Israel walks in obedience. But ultimately, we know from past Torah portions that there would come a day when Israel would return to their God, and they would return to His commands, and they would fulfill this destiny. And so this blessing is, like Jacob's, Moses' last act. He is going to bless the ones, ironically, who were indirectly responsible for his transgression, which made it impossible for him to cross over into the land. And so, understanding that, where others might be tempted to curse them, he instead blesses them, the very ones who made it impossible for him to cross over into the land. But if you think about it, he could do no less than what Balaam did. Of course, Balaam sought to curse Israel, but because God had determined he could not, he had to bless Israel. So the leader of the people, Moses, could do no less than that, obviously. He has to go beyond that. And so he blesses them individually, and he pronounces what's going to befall them, their destinies, etc. Now, the blessing is directed to the entire nation, because it says the children of Israel, but he gets very specific with each of the tribes, because each tribe's success is crucial for the overall welfare and the success of the nation. And in this verse, we also see that Moses is referred to as the man of God, or Ish HaElohim. He is also referred to this, or by this title, again in Joshua chapter 14, in Psalm 90, in the heading there. But we understand that Moses is the man of God, Ish HaElohim. Then verse 2, it says that the Lord came from Sinai, and at his right hand was a fiery law. Of course, Sinai was the starting point of the revelation that God had given to Israel. He gave them the Torah. He gave them the covenant. And this is the starting point of this calling out of the nations a people, a nation called Israel, with a particular way to live, this covenant of law. Now, it says that he presented it with his right hand, because It is my understanding that the right hand denotes power, it denotes authority. But as a believer, we also see a hint in this, because at his right hand, this is where Yeshua is seated, if I can use that word, or positioned. Matthew chapter 22, beginning at verse 42. Yeshua speaks and he says, "What do you think about the Messiah?" He's speaking to a group of people who are learned in the Torah. He says, "Whose son is he?" And they said to him, "The son of David." And he said to them, "How then does David in the Spirit call him Lord, saying, 'The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand,'" that is this position of authority and power, "'sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool.' If David then calls him Lord, how is he his son?" And we won't get into all of the nuances here, but the point is, he is making it very clear, that is Yeshua, that he is the son of David, and yet he is David's Lord, and he is the one who is at the right hand of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. He is the one who is in that position of power and authority. Of course, the point here is, the Lord came from Sinai in verse 2 of our Torah portion, and with his right hand, and at his right hand, it says, was a fiery law. Acts chapter 5, verse 31, God has exalted him, that is Yeshua, to his right hand to be prince and savior, to give repentance to Israel and forgiveness of sins. Again, in the book of Acts chapter 7, verse 55. But he, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven. Of course, this is speaking of Stephen. And he, Stephen, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven and saw the glory of God and Yeshua standing at the right hand of God and said, "Look, I see the heavens opened and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." And so this is all to say that at the right hand of the Creator is the Messiah, is Yeshua. He is in the position of authority. And according to our Torah portion, it is God's right hand that presented this fiery law, which in turn also hints at Yeshua, because of course Yeshua is the Word made flesh. And so what I'm getting at is that the Messiah was present. The Word was present there. And when God presented the covenant to Israel, it was with this fiery law. It was with his right hand that he does these things. Now, when God presented the covenant to Israel, of course, it was amidst this display of fire and lightning and this very frightening, if I can use that word, spectacle. This is how the people beheld. This is how this revelation all came about. Now, this fiery law is all hinted at the beginning, as a matter of fact, in the word Breshit, in the beginning. If you look at that word, of course, the root word is Rosh, which is Resh Aleph Shin. But at the heart of that word Breshit is another word, and it's Aleph Shin. In fact, it's the center letters. There's six letters in the word Breshit: Bet, Resh, Aleph, Shin, Yud, Tav. If you take the heart of the word, or the center of it, it's Aleph Shin, which is the Hebrew word for Esh, or fire. The remaining letters, the Bet, the Resh, the Yud, the Tav, is the word Brit, or covenant. And so, hinted at in the beginning, or in Breshit, is Brit Esh, that is a covenant of fire. And so there are two parallel things going on here. He brings them this revelation from Sinai. At his right hand is this fiery law that he presents to the people. It is a covenant of fire. "Is not my word like a fire, says the Lord," according to Jeremiah chapter 23. And simultaneously, what we are to understand as believers is that the word is present here. He is at the right hand, so to speak. It is his right hand who is presenting this fiery law to the people. Now, in verse 3, it says that he loves the peoples, all his holy ones, and they sit down at his feet. And so there are two different ways of looking at this particular verse. The peoples, referring to the tribes of Israel. The holy ones, just kind of emphasizing that he's speaking of the tribes of Israel. Yet, we know, he so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. And from those in the world, he embraces all of the holy ones, all the ones who set themselves apart from those cultures, those nations, those countries to which they have been born. And so he embraces all of the holy ones who come from all peoples. In fact, those who are considered to be set apart ones or holy ones from all these different peoples are in the end what constitutes his people Israel. Some are of the natural branch, some are of the wild branch that is grafted in. But all of them sit at his feet. Now, in the context of what Moses says, or from the perspective, I guess you'd say, from where Moses is coming, you could see it that he gathers them at Sinai. He displays this manifestation of fire and lightning in this very awesome spectacle. He presents his law to them. He presents his Torah, this fiery law, to them. And they are assembled at his feet, so to speak, at the foot of Mount Sinai in order to learn his instructions. But then we also understand that later on, when Yeshua is going around the countryside 2,000 years ago, that there were those who wanted to sit at his feet to hear his instructions. These are the people who are separating themselves from everybody else. Luke chapter 10, verse 39 records that Martha, her sister, called Mary, sat at Yeshua's feet and heard his word. And so those who he loves, those who are regarded as his holy ones, are also those who sit at his feet to hear his instructions. Now in verse 4 it says that Moses commanded a law, an inheritance of Jacob. We understand that the Torah is entrusted to Israel. It's not entrusted to the nations. It's entrusted to Israel. As a matter of fact, the word that is rendered inheritance, morasha, might be better rendered as heritage, not inheritance. Because an inheritance is something that may be spent, it may be sold off by the heir at their discretion. But a heritage is an estate, and that estate must be preserved for future generations. In other words, it's going to have to remain in the family. It can't be sold off to somebody just because you want to get the income. It's something that has to remain in the family. And so the Torah is entrusted to Israel. The Torah is entrusted to the family, those set-apart ones, his holy ones from the peoples. And his Torah is to be transmitted from generation to generation. It is to be preserved for future generations. It is to be considered an heritage. Now, Yeshua speaks to this concept in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6. He says this, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." I believe that speaks very clearly to this concept that the Torah is given to God's people called Israel. It is their heritage, and it is something that has been entrusted to them to pass down to future generations, and not to turn it over to dogs, not to turn it over to things that are unclean, that would have no regard for its holiness. They would simply trample it under their feet. Now, the Hebrew word morasha, which is again, perhaps better rendered heritage, is said to be related to the term meorasa, or married, because there is this idea that Israel is married to the Torah. Israel is married to God's word. And if we see that Yeshua is the living word, the living Torah, then Israel is his bride. And who is Israel? According to the biblical understanding of Israel, those who keep the commands of God, those who walk according to his instructions, those who hear what he says, those who do what he says. Now in verse 5 it says, "And there was a king in Yeshurun," indicating that God becomes king. He is regarded as king when Israel accepted the Torah. Now some rabbis claim that the Torah is the king in Yeshurun, because the Torah is Israel's authority. And that is not saying two different things. At least I don't believe so, because the word is an expression of the Creator. It's not going to say anything he wouldn't say. It's not going to do anything he wouldn't do. It's simply a manifestation of who he is. Because you can't say you believe in God and not his instructions. You can't say, I believe in God, but I don't believe in the Torah. Because to deny the Torah, his word, an expression of who he is to deny God himself. And so to say something like that would be to say, I have a king who has no authority. Well, a king with no authority is not a king. So all that is to say that this rabbinical idea that the Torah is the king referred to in Yeshurun is not to say that God isn't. Because, again, they're one and the same. Now let's go one step further. Considering that the Messiah is the Torah personified, then we could make the argument based on this rabbinical interpretation that the Messiah, Yeshua, is the king in Yeshurun. And of course, Yeshurun is to indicate Israel when Israel is walking upright. Because Yeshar, the root of Yeshurun, means to be upright, to be straightforward. Now in verse 6, as we move into the blessings themselves, it begins with Reuben, who of course is the firstborn. And Moses says, let Reuben live and not die. Or if we can put it this way, long live Reuben. Now, there's many ideas as to why he says this, but one of those would include the fact that Reuben dwells across the Jordan on the east and would be one of the tribes that was exposed to attacks from neighboring enemies. Some interpret this to mean that Reuben requires this statement, long live Reuben, more or less, because Reuben had been chastised by Jacob because Reuben had defiled his father's bed. He had cohabitated with Jacob's concubine, Bilhah. In fact, in Genesis chapter 49, we read, Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, you shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. And so consequently, Moses prays that Reuben's tendencies to stray would not bring him to destruction, that this tribe would always be included in the census when the people were counted. Don't let Reuben be diminished. In other words, that these things of the past would not pop up again and result in Reuben not being counted amongst the tribes, not being included in the count of the people. Because these past incidents, of course, would include the fact that Reuben produced Dathan and Abiram. And these are two men who, along with the Kohathites under Korach, rebelled against Moses and Aaron. Now in verse 7, Moses says, hear, Lord, the voice of Judah. Of course, Judah is the tribe from which the Davidic line would descend, which would include the Messiah. And Judah was the princely tribe, who would be the leading tribe in wars for the land of Israel, because we understand that Judah always goes first. In the camp in the wilderness, it was the camp of Judah that led the way. And so Moses' prayer was that Judah's armies, as they leaned the way, would be victorious, and that God would hear their voice and he would hearken to their prayers for guidance, for protection, as they go about to win these wars. Now, it is noted that Shimon or Simeon is omitted from these blessings. And it is believed that Simeon is included as part of Judah's blessing, because Simeon's 19 unconnected cities were mainly in the southern part of the nation or in Judah's territory. And so because Simeon's population was considered to be so small, he was more or less assimilated into the host tribe, in this particular case, Judah. So it is believed, anyway, that Simeon's not mentioned because he's really included in the blessing that is given to Judah. Now, we should point out, according to Jacob's blessings, Simeon had been castigated more or less in Genesis chapter 49, verse 5. We should point out that the men from Simeon had been heavily involved in the rebellion of Baal Peor And of course, that's related to us in Numbers chapter 25, verse 3 and verse 14. But at any rate, Simeon is believed to be part of Judah's blessing. Now, in verses 8 through 11, we get into the blessing of Levi, which begins with the priest and then includes the entire tribe. And other commentators will attach Simeon to the tribe of Levi instead of Judah because of Jacob's blessing. Let's read it here, Genesis 49, verse 5. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Instruments of cruelty are in their dwelling place. Let not my soul enter their council. Let not my honor be united to their assembly. For in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they hamstrung an ox. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will divide them in Jacob, and scatter them in Israel. And of course, Levi, Moses' tribe, by the way, is dispersed among the tribes because the Levites, they lived in all these different communities amongst all these different tribes, were given cities throughout the land. So they were, in fact, dispersed among the tribes. But Simeon as well is being dispersed among the tribes. Now back to Levi, verse 8, Moses says, "May your Tumim and your Urim be with your Holy One." Of course, the Holy One would refer to Levi, and the Tumim and Urim would refer to the breastplate. Of course, the priest would at times go to inquire of the Lord by the Urim and Tumim. And Moses makes the point that Levi had been proved at Massah and Meribah. And these are instances when Moses and Aaron, who were both of the tribe of Levi, were challenged by the people. In both cases, the people are crying out for water. And this is recorded in Exodus chapter 17 and in Numbers chapter 20. But the point is, and I believe this is what Moses is saying, because we proved ourselves faithful. Levi proved to be faithful in these instances. Then let your Urim and Tumim always remain with Levi. Now, verse 9, speaking of Levi still, it says, "Who said of his father and of his mother, I have not seen him." In other words, suggesting that in carrying out its duties as the priestly tribe, that Levi makes no distinction between father and mother, doesn't make allowances for their brethren, their kinsmen, their mother, their father, their close friends, but they do what they're instructed to do without any distinctions, making no allowances for other people just because they're closely connected to them. He goes on and he says, "Neither did he acknowledge his brethren." Of course, Levi, we understand, went through the camp after the golden calf incident and was instructed to slay anybody who was associated with this sin, including your relative, your friend, your neighbor. It doesn't matter. If they're guilty, slay them. And so he didn't acknowledge his brethren, is to say he did what he was instructed to do, not making allowances for those who were closely connected to him. It says of Levi that they observed, which is literally guarded, your word, and keep or consecrate your covenant. Of course, this is reiterated for us later on in Malachi. Speaking of Levi in chapter 2, it says, beginning at verse 4, "Then you shall know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant with Levi may continue, says the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him, one of life and peace, and I gave them to him that he might fear me. So he feared me and was reverent before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, and turned many away from iniquity. For the lips of a priest should keep knowledge, and people should seek the law from his mouth, for he is the messenger of the Lord of hosts." Of course, as we continue to read that prophecy, which we won't do here, there are some things that the Creator has to say about Levi's deficiencies. But the point is that Moses blesses them and appeals to the Creator, "Because of our being faithful to you in times past, when we've been tested, we've guarded your word, we've consecrated your covenant, let your Urim, let your Tumim always be with the tribe of Levi." Now in verse 10, it says that they shall teach Jacob your ordinances and Israel your law. And this is exactly what we read in Malachi chapter 2. It's just being reiterated. Because they didn't align themselves with the rebels at Sinai. Let it be that they teach Jacob your instructions, that they will teach Israel your law. And in order to teach all of Israel your law and your ordinances would infer that they have to be scattered among the tribes. They have to be where all the tribes are. They can't just be in one place. And so fulfilling Jacob's prophecy and fulfilling Moses' prophecy means they're going to have to be scattered among the tribes in order that they may teach Israel your law. Now, we've already read it, but we should also acknowledge that Jacob scolded Levi for his aggression. But what we see in the wilderness is that aggressive nature that Levi had, the thing that Jacob castigated, has been turned to good in the wilderness, because that aggression caused them to be able to go through the camp and to slay those who had wrought this great evil in Israel, to remove the evil from their midst. And so what is on one side kind of a negative thing is turned into a positive thing, because their aggression is used to guide others away from transgression. As a point of interest, Aaron, who's of the tribe of Levi, assisted the people in their sin when it came to the golden calf. He's the one who kind of let the fence down so that they can mix and mingle. But then later, he is put in the position to lead the people away from mixing the holy with the profane, if you will. God took something that was unwholesome, and he turned it into something that was good. Now in verse 11 it says, still speaking of Levi, "Bless his substance and accept the work of his hands." In other words, bless his ability to perform the duties that you have delegated to him. Indirectly, we could say that God provide for Levi temporarily so that he may focus on his spiritual duties. In other words, don't let him be burdened down with having to go out and grow food and make sure that his family is able to eat. Because if he's doing that all the time, then he's not going to be able to perform the duties that you have delegated to him. So provide for him, bless his substance, and accept the work of his hands. Now, in verse 12, we get into another tribe. This is the beloved of the Lord, which is the tribe of Benjamin. And Moses says, "The beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him." Because we see and understand that Benjamin was favored by Jacob. Remember when the brothers were to go back down to Egypt to get more grain, this would be their second trip down, they were told by the man who we know to be Joseph to not return unless they brought this other brother, Benjamin, with them. And of course, Jacob was very, very slow to allow that to happen, because Benjamin is the only son he has remaining from Rachel. And so he's very, very hesitant to allow him to go. He is the son of my right hand. So because he was favored by Jacob, he is favored by God. And so he is regarded as the beloved of the Lord. Now, there are opinions offered as to why Jacob and God favored him so. One reason would be he was the only tribal leader that was born in the land. Everybody else had been born in Aram or Syria. He was the only one who did not take part in the sale of Joseph. And as we just alluded to, he was the son who comforted Jacob in his old age. But at any rate, he is the favored or the beloved of the Lord. And it says that he shall dwell in safety by him, because later on, when the temple is built, the actual sanctuary was going to be built in Benjamin's tribal portion, not in Judah's. Jerusalem is primarily situated in Judah's territory, but the temple sat in Benjamin's territory. In fact, the courts of the temple were in Judah's territory, but the sanctuary itself was in Benjamin. And so, one opinion is, the reason Benjamin's blessing follows Levi's is because Levi, of course, is the tribe who ministers there in the temple. But Benjamin is the host for the temple. Now, here's a footnote to all of this. The Mishkan, the tabernacle, of course, was situated in Shiloh, before the temple was built, was situated in Shiloh, which is part of Ephraim's portion, or tribal lands. And of course, Ephraim is the offspring of Joseph. And the Mishkan sat there for over 200 years. So consequently, after Levi, you have Benjamin. But after Benjamin, you're going to have the blessing of Joseph, which we'll get to in just a moment. Now, still speaking of Benjamin, it says that he covers him all the day, and he, that is the Creator, dwells between his shoulders. And so when the temple was dedicated in Benjamin's territory, the Shekinah, of course, comes down into the most holy place. The priest cannot stand to minister. And so the Shekinah covers, if you will, Benjamin. And when the temple was built, the central sanctuary was never again moved to any other location. Once the central sanctuary was established in Jerusalem or in Benjamin's territory, never again was it moved. In other words, he dwells between his shoulders. Literally, if you will, you can look at it that those rocky hills of Jerusalem upon which the temple sat were the shoulders of Benjamin. Now, following Benjamin, of course, is the twin tribe, that is Joseph, who is divided up into Manasseh and Ephraim. And it says that Joseph is highly favored and he's promised prosperity. In fact, Moses' blessing of Joseph parallels that of Jacob, if you want to compare the two. Now, there are some resources that suggest, or speculate, maybe that's the word, that the reason Joseph is promised so much prosperity, or the reason so much prosperity is desired for Joseph, is because in Joseph, there is future catastrophe. In other words, that blessing given to Joseph hints at what's coming down the road. Of course, from Joseph comes Jeroboam. And Jeroboam is the one who led the northern kingdom into idolatry and into exile. And of course, Joseph's territory is occupied by Edom to this very time. So again, there was this hint within the blessing of Joseph that there was a future catastrophe. At least that's what some rabbinical sources say. Now, as we continue in verse 13, it says, "Blessed of the Lord be his land," indicating that Joseph would dwell in a very fertile land, good for growing, and that he would be promised the abundant rain. In fact, he'd be promised these subterranean springs, and so it'd be a well-watered place that was capable of being very fertile and producing a lot of the abundance of the land. In verse 14, it talks about the fruits of the sun and the yield of the moon. In other words, those things that are warmed by the sun and those things that grow particularly at night. There are some things, as I understand it, that while the sun brings the warmth and all the things that those plants need, there are some things that actually don't produce the fruit until it's nighttime. They only grow when it's dark. And some examples that are given are melons, cucumbers, etc. So this is kind of an interesting thing to consider, and particularly because it's speaking of Joseph and likening Joseph to this. So speaking in strictly spiritual terms, if there are some things that only grow when it's dark, Joseph and all that that entails is really going to mature when it's dark. Think about what I'm saying here. It's daytime right now, prophetically speaking, but we understand it's getting dark. And in Joseph, we have a prophecy that he would enjoy this abundance, both those things that grow in the daytime and those things that mature at night. And so perhaps, if you consider what Joseph really represents, because Joseph is that one that was separated from his brethren, that there's going to be a particular element of Joseph that prospers and is in abundance in the daytime, but there's also that aspect that prospers and comes to maturity and fruition when it's dark. And I submit to you, it's getting dark. Now, we don't have time to go off onto that little rabbi trail, but I think you can understand what I'm trying to say here, that prophetically speaking, there are some things that are beginning to mature now. There are things that are going to come into abundance when it gets dark. Now in verse 16, it says, "Let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and that he is to be prince among his brethren. So the blessing is on the head of Joseph. He is to be a prince among the brothers. Compare this to what Jacob had to say about Joseph in Genesis chapter 49, verse 26. He said, "The blessings of your father have excelled the blessings of my ancestors." In other words, Jacob's saying, "I've been blessed more than Isaac, more than Abraham, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They, these blessings, shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of him who was separate from his brothers." And so it's important to consider that the prince among his brethren was the one who was separated from his brethren, and that his blessings, which are likened to fruit that prospers both in the daytime and that fruit that prospers at night or when it's dark, that those blessings that come upon the head of Joseph are going to surpass that of his ancestors. It's very interesting. It says that of Joseph, "His firstling bullock, majesty is his, and his horns are of the wild ox." Now, most commentators agree that this particular part of the blessing is referring to his firstborn, or in a spiritual context, not just natural terms, but in a spiritual context. And of course, that firstborn would be Ephraim. So we remember in Genesis 48, when Joseph brings Manasseh and Ephraim to Jacob to be blessed, that Jacob crosses his hands. He puts the right hand upon the head of Ephraim. Joseph tries to intervene, but Jacob basically says, "I know what I'm doing. I'm going to do it this way." And so he promotes Ephraim as the firstborn in a spiritual sense. So anyway, we understand that his firstling bullock, its majesty is given to him, and it says, "and his horns are like the wild ox." Now, some contend that this particular part of the blessing speaks specifically of Joshua, who, of course, is the descendant of Ephraim from Joseph. But all that is to say, it just kind of validates this idea that the firstling bullock is referring to Ephraim. His horns speak of strength. And commentators contend that Joseph, of course, is likened unto an ox by Jacob in Genesis chapter 49, verse 6. He is symbolized by an ox or a bull. Of course, Ephraim's camp was symbolized by the ox or the bull. But at any rate, these horns are speaking of strength. And with his horns, it says that he will gore the peoples, even the ends of the earth. And which is to say that his influence, his power, speaking of Joseph, will go over the whole earth. In fact, these horns would also bring Manasseh into the scenario, because in verse 17 it says that they are the 10,000s of Ephraim and the thousands of Manasseh. And the word him, they, is believed to refer to the two horns of Joseph. So again, the two horns would refer to Ephraim, the 10,000s of Ephraim, and the thousands of Manasseh. Of course, an example would be in that Joshua, who was of the tribe of Ephraim, gored, if I can use that word, the Canaanites. You've got a man by the name of Gideon, or Gideon, who was of the tribe of Manasseh, who destroyed the Midianites. But anyway, just to summarize, this blessing is telling us that Joseph is going to be blessed. He is going to be a prince among his brethren. His influence through his descendants is going to reach unto the ends of the earth, and they are going to influence and have power over, to some degree, the inhabitants of the earth to the ends of the earth. Now, in verse 18, it moves from Joseph to speaking of Zebulun. Of course, it says, "Rejoice, Zebulun, in your going out, and Issachar, in your tents." And it is my understanding that the reason that these two tribes are mentioned in the same blessing is because these two tribes were in somewhat of a partnership. It is understood that Zebulun was engaged in maritime enterprises, had a vast merchant marine, if I can use that term, and through its revenues supported the tribe of Issachar, because the tribe of Issachar supposedly dedicated its time to its tents. That is the tents of study. And there seems to be some credence to this because in 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 32, it tells us of the sons of Issachar who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do. Their chiefs were 200, and all their brethren were at their command. Now Zebulun's territory stretched from the Lake of Kinneret, which was also called the Sea of Galilee, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. And so Zebulun is, according to Jacob's words, the one who is going to dwell at the shore of the sea. Now Issachar, because it has understanding of the times, is said to have had intimate knowledge of the most complex of halakhic issues because they've dedicated all their time to study, being supported by Zebulun. In fact, these 200 chiefs, according to some rabbinical commentaries, instructed the entire nation in specifically calendar issues because they had understanding of the times. Boy, don't some of us wish they were here now to settle some of these calendar issues we have. But at any rate, it's very interesting to consider that these two tribes kind of collaborated with one another on a very, very intimate basis, one supporting the other. And we would conclude, and I think deduce, that if Zebulun is blessing them in a temporal way so that Issachar can devote themselves to study, then the fruits of this study is going to come back to bless Zebulun to know what to do. Now in chapter 33, verse 20 through 21, we have the blessing of the tribe of Gad, whose territory, like Reuben's, was also east of the Jordan River. And of course, this was the area of Sion and the Amorites and Og. And God's territory was larger than most of the western tribes. In verse 20, it kind of alludes to that because he says, "Blessed be he that enlarges God. He dwells as a lioness." So in other words, he dwells as someone who will defend his territory and that of the neighboring tribes because the tribe of God was famed as being very courageous in war. In 1 Chronicles, as a matter of fact, in chapter 12, we read verse 8 that says, "Some Gadites joined David at the stronghold in the wilderness, mighty men of valor, men trained for battle, who could handle shield and spear, whose faces were like the faces of lions, and were as swift as gazelles on the mountains." Now in verse 21, it says that God, he chose a first part for himself. That is, along with Reuben, the tribe of Gad was one of the first tribes to choose its territory. And this is recorded for us in Numbers chapter 32. Specifically, he chose the territory of Sion and Og. Of course, this was the first conquered territory of Eretz Israel. And Moses says of God that he executed the righteousness of the Lord. In other words, when Reuben and Gad and the half-tribe of Manasseh wanted to settle east of Jordan, one of the conditions was that when it came time to war against the Canaanites in Israel proper, that these tribes had to go over with the other tribes to help them secure their homeland. And of course, God fulfilled the promise to do that, to cross the Jordan, to fight along the side the other tribes against the Canaanites. Now, what's interesting about this, though, is as Moses speaks this, that has not yet happened. And yet he says it as if it has already happened. Now, verse 22, it says that Dan, we're going from the God to Dan, that Dan is a lion's whelp. Now, compare that to Jacob's blessing, where Dan is a serpent. And there's been a lot of conjecture about Dan, and that some people say the Antichrist comes from the tribe of Dan, because Dan is not mentioned in the book of Revelation, and he's a serpent, etc. Well, let's read it in Genesis 49, verse 17. "Dan shall be a serpent by the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels so that its rider shall fall backward." But if you take that comparison and then Moses' comparison, it would seem to suggest that more than being evil and wicked and serpent's seed and all those kinds of things, that the tribe of Dan is going to be very quick to strike at its enemies and to defend its domain. Because like God, Dan's territory was on the border, so to speak. It was on the Mediterranean. So God was going to be one of the first tribes to encounter invasions from the east. Well, Dan was going to be one of the first tribes to encounter invasion by sea or from the west. Samson was from the tribe of Dan, and he was a staunch defender of the Israelites. So both of these are to suggest that Dan is going to be very quick to defend his domain, to defend his country. In fact, it says that he leaps forth from Bashan. Of course, Bashan is the area where the Jordan River originates, and in Hebrew, the Jordan River is Yarden, which is to say, if you break that word down, Yod, Resh, Dalet, Nun, Yarden, it could be rendered comes down from or flows from Dan, Yorod, Dan. And so again, all of this is suggesting that more than being evil, that Dan is going to be very quick to leap into battle in defense of its country. Now in verse 23, it moves to Naphtali, and it says, Naphtali, satisfied with favor and full with the blessing of the Lord, because the land of Naphtali was some of the richest and the most fertile land in Eretz Israel. In fact, Naphtali's territory encompassed much of what was called, or is called, the Galilee, or the Galil. And it says of Naphtali that besides this favor and blessing, that he will possess the sea and the south, which is the Sea of Galilee, the Hule region. And beyond the possession of the Sea of Galilee and these very fertile lands, we also understand, according to the Gospels, that Naphtali and Zebulun were going to be blessed in other ways. And so what's recorded for us in Matthew chapter 4, beginning at verse 13, is, And leaving Nazareth, he, that is Yeshua, came and dwelt in Capernaum, or Kfar Nahum, which is by the sea, that is the Sea of Galilee, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet. In fact, that's referring to Isaiah chapter 9, verse 1, which says, The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, by the way of the sea, beyond the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles, the people who sat in darkness have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the region in shadow of death, light has dawned. And so Naphtali is one of those tribes that is full of favor and full with the blessing of the Lord in more ways than one. Now, verse 24, Moses blesses Asher, or Asher. In fact, he says, Blessed be Asher above sons, let him be favored and dip his foot in oil. Now Asher, which means happy or fortunate, when he was born, Leah said that she was the most fortunate or happy of women. That's in Genesis chapter 30. Now Asher as a tribe was to enjoy exceptional prosperity. In other words, to dip his feet in oil. That is considered to be a metaphor for great abundance, because supposedly there was a great abundance of olive trees that were in Asher's territory. But of course, I think many of you are aware that many have interpreted this to be that literally in Asher's territory, one day people are going to find petroleum, that it's going to be discovered in this area, and it's going to upset the apple cart in the geopolitical world in that region. Whether that's true or not true, I can't say one way or the other. It is something very interesting to consider. There are many companies that are exploring whether or not there is any oil or an abundance of oil. And depending on who you read and you listen to, you can hear all different types of opinion. As far as that particular point, it remains to be seen. But what we do understand from the blessing is that in this abundance of oil, he would be pleasing to his brethren. His prosperity, or the source of his prosperity, that because of this, he's going to please his brethren. Now, some sources interpret that to mean this, that these daughters of Asher, who were very beautiful, many of them married Kohanim, or priests. And of course, the priest being anointed with oil, they tie these two concepts together. Here's why I even bring that out. Because it is very interesting to me that when Miriam is completed the days of her purification after the birth of Yeshua, and she presents herself to the temple, and she brings the child there, of course, Simeon greets them, and he says, "Now, Lord, you can let me die. I've seen the salvation of Israel," etc. But we also see in Luke chapter 2 that there was one Anna, or Hannah, a prophetess, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of a great age, and this woman was a widow of about 84 years, who did not depart from the temple, but served God with fastings and prayers night and day. Just an interesting thing to consider in connection to the belief that the pleasing to the brethren is going to be these daughters who marry these priests. Just a footnote, more or less. Now, in verse 25, it says of Asher that iron and brass shall be your bars, suggesting that his dwelling would be impenetrable. Of course, the tribe of Asher dwelt in the northern regions of the country, which were considered to be very vulnerable. In fact, we can see that most of Israel's troubles, invasions, wars, have came from the north. In Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 14, it says, "The Lord said to me, out of the north calamity shall break forth on all the inhabitants of the land." And so Moses is appealing, blessing, however you'd like to say it, that Asher will be as strong as iron and brass, that his bars will be that strong, that his dwelling place would not be vulnerable to attack. Now, in verse 26, Moses says this, "There is none like unto God, O Yeshurun," which is to say, there is nothing to fear if Israel is upright. Again, Yeshurun comes from Yashar, which means to be upright. And so if you are walking as Yeshurun, upright before God, there's nothing to fear. In fact, when you're walking in that way, he will ride upon the heaven as your help. When you are obedient, he will come to your assistance. The word rides is the word from the word rachav. And rachav is a word from which we get another word called merkava. And merkava is the Hebrew word for chariot. So the implication is this, that when Israel walks as Yeshurun, upright before God, that the Creator will ride to your assistance. He will come to war on your behalf. He will bring his chariot to the battle, because there is this concept in Judaism that the Merkava of God is basically his throne, which upon which he sits. But at times that throne literally becomes his chariot, his war chariot, upon which he rides to the defense of his people when they are walking in obedience. A hint at this is in 2 Samuel chapter 5, verse 22. "Then the Philistines went up once again and deployed themselves in the valley of Rephaim. Therefore David inquired of the Lord, and he said," this is the Lord speaking to David, "You shall not go up. Circle around behind them, and come upon them in front of the mulberry trees. And it shall be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the mulberry trees," marching in the tops of the mulberry trees, "then you shall advance quickly. For then the Lord will go out before you to strike the camp of the Philistines." And David did so as the Lord commanded him, and he drove back the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. In other words, all that is to say that when Israel walks in obedience, when they are walking upright, the Creator promises to ride upon the heaven as your help. To, if I can put it this way, to ride his chariot into battle on your behalf, to defeat your enemies. In verse 27, it says that the eternal God is a dwelling place. In other words, he is Israel's refuge. Moses said this later on in Psalm 90. "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations," not just in the past generations, not just in present generations, but in all generations. And so what we can deduce from that is this, that regardless of where we find ourselves, regardless of what's going on in the world, regardless of who may be leading the nations of the world, those world leaders should be considered as insignificant compared to the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Even the mightiest people on the earth today are still people, and they are bound to the earth. But the God of Israel transcends the universe. So regardless of what's going on in the world, we understand that He is our dwelling place in all generations, and that if we walk upright, He will ride upon the heavens to our assistance. Verse 28 says that Israel dwells in safety, the fountain of Jacob alone, which is to say that Israel, when it's walking upright, will dwell securely and solitary. In other words, because the enemy has been vanquished, Israel can dwell safely as a nation. But each Israelite can dwell safely and individually without need for communal protection because the enemies have been overcome. Consider the Moshavim and the Kibbutzim in Israel. Since 1948, have played a very integral role in the defense of Israel during war. Well, why have these communal entities, the Moshav, the Kibbutz, why have they been so instrumental in the defense of Israel? Because the enemies have not been vanquished. But what this promise is saying is that there comes a day that you won't have to do that. You won't have to depend on these communal entities for protection. You could live alone because the enemy has been vanquished, because Israel dwells in safety. That is not the present situation at hand, and that's the point. And so perhaps this is speaking of a future time. Now note what Jacob says to Joseph. Remember, who is the one separated from his brethren. And we're linking what Jacob says to Joseph to what we just mentioned. He says, "Then Israel said to Joseph, 'Behold, I am dying, but God will be with you and bring you back to the land of your fathers.'" In other words, right now, Israel does not dwell in safety. Right now, there is this need to come together from an Israeli point of view to be protected from enemies, to live in the Moshav, to live in the Kibbutz, etc., to live in these communities, these settlements, etc. The prophecy is, or the blessing is, that there comes a day that you're going to dwell in safety and you're not going to have to live or depend on that kind of a situation. But that's not the situation now. So again, going back to what Israel tells Joseph, God will be with you and will bring you back to the land of your fathers, leads us to this, and that is that there is a widespread belief in Judaism that Israel will not dwell in safety until Joseph is reunited with his brother. You know, Joseph, who's the one who is a prince among his brethren, who is bountiful, whose influence reaches the ends of the earth, who is fruitful as those things that are warmed by the sun and as those things that yield their fruit at night. This one has to be reunited with his brother in order that Israel be able to dwell in safety. And if you consider the prophecies in Ezekiel chapter 36, and Ezekiel 37, and Obadiah, you will see that this reunification of Joseph and of his brother is very instrumental in the end days. Now, verse 29, Moses says, "Israel, who is like unto you? A people saved by the Lord." In other words, Israel is a unique people who are victorious not by their might nor their power, but by His Spirit. And Israel, he says, is a people who shall tread upon their high places. The Hebrew term is al bamotemo, al upon, bamot, bamot is high places, bamotemo is their high places. Now some translations render high places as haughty ones. They're lifted up ones, they're lofty ones, etc. An example is found in Joshua chapter 10, verses 24 through 26, when Joshua tells these Israelite captains to put their feet on the neck of these Canaanite kings. You're going to trample or tread upon their haughty ones. But there's, I believe, a prophetic significance to this as well, because in Malachi chapter 4, 1 through 3, we see, "For behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, and all the proud, yes, all who do wickedly will be stubble. And the day which is coming shall burn them up, says the Lord of hosts, that will leave them neither root nor branch. But do you who fear my name, the Son of Righteousness, shall arise with healing in his wings, and you shall go out and grow fat like stall-fed calves. You shall trample the wicked, for they shall be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day that I do this, says the Lord of hosts." Now, that, if you continue to read, is the context of this prophecy. "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and dreadful day of the Lord. He will turn the hearts of the fathers to the children, and the children to the fathers, lest I come and strike the earth with a curse." In other words, what we just read in Malachi sets the tone for the days of Elijah, when his people are going to overcome, are going to trample on the wicked, tread upon their haughty ones, so to speak. And it all has to do with the coming of Elijah, who, according to 1 Kings 17, was of the inhabitants of Gilead. And of course, Gilead is a descendant of Joseph. And Israel won't dwell in complete safety until Joseph is reunited with his brother. And so, we could also see how that high places plays a significant role in this, not just lofty ones or haughty ones, but literally high places, because that could allude to the high mountains of Israel, which is prophetic as well. And if you read in Ezekiel 36, the Creator prophesies to the mountains and the hills, if you will, the high places of Israel, promising the mountains and the hills of Israel that His people Israel will come and they will walk upon them, after Edom has been displaced from them. And if you continue to read into Ezekiel 37, that is the prelude to the reunification of Joseph and Judah. In other words, the mountains of Israel that have been claimed by the enemy is displaced, his people Israel come, they walk upon the mountains, and then in Ezekiel 37, we see Joseph and Judah being reunited. Now, in chapter 34, this is the very last chapter of this book, the last chapter of the Torah, and in the chapter, we see that Moses dies. He blesses the people, and then he ascends Mount Nebo to be gathered unto his fathers. Now, here's how Josephus records this day. This is in the Antiquity of the Jews, book 4, chapter 8. He says, quote, "Amidst the tears of the people, the women beating their breasts, and the children giving way to uncontrolled wailing, he withdrew. At a certain point in his ascent, he made a sign to the weeping multitude to advance no further, taking with him only the elders, the high priest Eleazar, and the general Joshua. At the top of the mountain, he dismissed the elders, and then, as he was embracing Eleazar and Joshua, and still speaking to them, a cloud suddenly stood over him, and he vanished into a deep valley." End quote. In verse 1, Moses ascends Nebo, which we also see is Pisgah, which is part of the Abarim Mountains, which is in Moab, which, it, interestingly enough, is Ruth's home. But at any rate, when he ascends the mountain, he is shown all the land unto Gilead, it mentions specifically, in the territory of Dan. That's interesting, because, as I just mentioned to you, Gilead is where we find Elijah. That's where Elijah dwelt. And from where Moses is seeing Gilead in the territory of Dan, that is from Mount Nebo, interestingly enough, in this general vicinity is where Elijah, who is of the inhabitants of Gilead, would later be taken up into heaven. So I find that kind of interesting that it specifically mentions Gilead, that area from which Elijah came. And it's interesting that Elijah was taken up into heaven in close proximity to the mountain from which Moses viewed all these things. And that's interesting because both these men, Moses and Elijah, appear with Yeshua on a mountain in Matthew chapter 17. Now there's a footnote to this, and that is something to do with the Abarim Mountains, because the Abarim Mountains figure prominently into the Battle of Gog of Magog, which is recorded for us in Ezekiel 38 and 9. But specifically in Ezekiel 39 verse 11, it says that after this battle and all these dead of Gog are laying around, it says that it will come to pass in that day that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel, the valley of those who pass by. Literally in Hebrew, it says Abarim. In other words, the Gai Valley, Abarim, which is to infer that this valley is in the Abarim mountain range, the same place where Moses is viewing all these things. In fact, Ezekiel 39:11 says that I will give Gog a burial place there in Israel. Please note that. In Israel, it will be the valley of Abarim, the Abarim Valley, east of the sea. Well, the sea would be the Dead Sea. And east of the Dead Sea means today it would be in the country of Jordan, in Moab. But notice Ezekiel 39 says that it's in Israel. We don't have time to get into all this, but the point is that something happens before Ezekiel 39 occurs that places the Abarim Mountains, so consequently the valley, in the possession of Israel. And it will obstruct travelers because they will bury Gog and all of his multitude. Therefore, they will call it the Valley of Haman Gog. All of that is to say that this very climactic battle is going to occur in the same region, at the very least, where Moses is viewing the land and where he was ultimately buried. This leads us to this. When Moses is taken to the top of the mountain and he is shown the land, it is believed that he is shown more than just the land, but that he's actually given a prophetic vision of all the things that would happen in the land at these notable places all the way up until Judgment Day. It mentions Dan as an example. And when it mentions Dan, that is interpreted to mean that Moses was shown the idolatry of Dan. He was shown the exile. In verse 2, it says that he was shown the land of Naphtali, which we've already mentioned is the Galilee. He was shown the land of Ephraim and Manasseh. In fact, it says as far as the Western Sea. Some translate that as Hinder Sea. But it's literally last sea, at the end sea, literally. Interpreted to hint that he was shown all the lands and all these particular points, but he was shown all the things that were going on in those particular points in the geography throughout time, all the way to the last day, or Judgment Day. One commentator even makes mention that he was shown these particular landmarks, including the Mount of Olives, Mount Zion, Bethlehem, and the events that happened there. And if this is true, then that means that Moses was shown events surrounding Yeshua's ministry. Because the Mount of Olives played prominently, Mount Zion played prominently, Bethlehem, all these things were significant. The land of Naphtali was significant in the ministry of Yeshua. So if he was indeed shown all of these prophetic events, then he was shown the ministry of Yeshua. So, interestingly, again, he is one of those that appears with Yeshua on the Mount of Transfiguration, talking to him. So Moses is able to see the land with his own eyes, and then, of course, he's going to be buried in a valley there. That's kind of interesting, a valley, in Moab near Beth Peor. Now, there is a question as to whether the part of the Torah that records Moses' death, there's a question as to whether Moses wrote this or if Joshua wrote this. Josephus says that God told Moses to write it and that he wrote it. Other opinions is that Joshua wrote it. Frankly, I tend to believe Moses probably did write it, because if God was showing him all these things that were going to happen as if they were, then he could certainly dictate to him his death. The fact he would be buried, where he'd be buried, but nobody knows where he's buried, etc. In verse 5, we see that Moses is called the servant, and that Hebrew word is Eved. The Eved of the Lord, because we see that Moses is obeying the Creator down to the last moment, even unto death. When he was alive, he's called man of God, Ish HaElohim. But as he dies, he's called servant, Eved. He is going to obey him. If you're not going to allow me to go into the land, if you are requiring that I ascend the mountain, listen to me, and thus die on the mountain, I'm going to obey you. That's where I'm going to go. And I'm going to obey you even unto death. I will be your servant. Which hints at Yeshua's example, who is the ultimate bondservant, serving the Father unto death, saying, and I'm paraphrasing, if you're requiring that I go to the top of the mountain and die, that's what I'm willing to do. Not my will, but your will be done. Which then we deduce from this, this is the calling that is placed upon you and me. We are to be bondservants. We are to die to ourselves in order that we might overcome the adversary. And so our identity as these people who have gone before us is determined by our master. If we are servants, then he is the master and he determines our identity. And we are to be committed unto death if we are going to be regarded as servants. And it says for us that he died according to the word of the Lord, which literally is at the mouth of the Lord. In other words, he died at the mouth of the Lord. Because rabbis write that God took his breath away with a kiss. He didn't die a painful, laborious death. God just simply took his breath away by his mouth. Which is interesting, because mankind was given breath or life by God breathing into his nostrils. And so Solomon records for us in Ecclesiastes 12, remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well. What is he talking about? Death. Because he says, then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit, the ruach, or the breath, will return to God who gave it. Interesting. Now, verse 6, it tells us that he was buried in the valley over against Beth Peor. And of course, Beth Peor is where Israel consorted with the women of Moab. This is when the one man takes this princess into the very side of the tabernacle and is cohabitating with her. And Pinchas takes a javelin and goes in and stops their activity. And he stays the plague. And of course, all of this was brought upon the people indirectly by Balaam. But this is where all that occurred. And so it's interesting that this would be the site of Moses' burial. And to this day, no one knows of the location of his grave, so that it would not become a shrine, obviously. But look at it this way. God made sure that Moses was concealed to this very day. And in other words, there are things about Moses that remain hidden, remain concealed. Think about it. When he died, we see that he was 120 years. And it says that his eye was not dim, nor his natural force abated. Literally, neither had his freshness left. In other words, you know, he wasn't some feeble old man who had one foot in the grave when all this culminated. No, he was full of vigor. And so if that's the case, and yet it's been determined now it's time for you to die, then his death was ordained at a certain point in time. And it just so happens that it's 120 years, which that's interesting because those are the years that correspond to the time God has determined for man. Genesis chapter 6, verse 3, and the Lord said, my spirit shall not strive with man forever, for he is indeed flesh, yet his days shall be 120 years. What does that mean in relation to Moses? I'm not sure, but I do find it very interesting. And even more interesting, considering that it says his eye wasn't dim, he wasn't going blind, his vigor was still there. He was still a very strong person in that sense and could have crossed over the land had not God decided that you can't. And so then you take into account that he's hidden, he's concealed. It's very interesting. It has a lot to say, I believe. And there are certain things about Moses that we're still trying to understand. And I don't mean the person, I mean what he wrote. Now, verse 8, it says that they wept for Moses 30 days, and then the mourning was ended. And at that point, they move on, and Joshua leads the people. And so what we see in this, or what I see in this, is that God always has a person or persons who are ready to assume the mantle of leadership before the other actually leaves the scene. You know, Moses has already laid his hands on Jacob, has already, in the sight of the people, ordained him to be his successor. So the people already know that, and yet Moses is still with them. So there's an overlapping time, if you will. But when Moses does die, it's already established who the leader is, who is going to step into place. When it was determined in the book of 1 Samuel that the house of Eli was to fall and that there would be no descendants to lead the people, God had already begun to place Samuel in that position. And so when the house of Eli did fall, Samuel simply stepped into the role that had already been established for him by the Creator. So prophetically speaking, if you think of a day coming to an end before another day can begin, there is this overlapping period, this interim period that we call evening. The sun is setting, the moon is rising. And there is that little overlapping time when both are kind of there at the same time. But God always has one ready to move into his place or their place before the other disappears. His successor, it says, Joshua, was full of the spirit of wisdom, which is to say, full of the spirit of God. In fact, the term full of the spirit of wisdom is Mele Ruach Chachma. Mele or Milo or Mila can also be rendered completed. And so we could look at Joshua as the one who is completed with the spirit of wisdom. Moses has led them to this point, but Moses can't go over. Now Joshua, the one who is full or completed with the spirit of wisdom or the spirit of God, is going to lead them into the land. In verse 10, we read that there had not arisen a prophet like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. And face to face suggests that Moses saw things, heard things, understood things that no other prophet saw, heard, understood. Rabbis believe that this is also suggesting that Moses was permitted to speak to God at will, whenever he wished. That's how close the relationship is. But going back to something we said, where Moses is hidden or concealed. We have a passage in Paul's writings to the congregation at Corinth. This is in 1 Corinthians chapter 2. He says that eye has not seen, ear has not heard, neither has it entered into the hearts of man what God has prepared for those who love him. And in the context of that passage, he's talking about hidden things, things that are concealed, specifically the word. But he goes on and he says that the Spirit of God is the one who searches, yes, the deep things of God. And he reveals these things to us. And so here's what I'm saying. There has not arisen a prophet like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, who heard things, who saw things, who understood things that no other prophet had saw. But we believe that there comes a day when the Creator is going to allow us to see things that we've never seen before, to hear things we've never heard before, to understand and perceive things that we've never understood or perceived, not because of who we are, but because He, by His Spirit, reveals these things to us. And it's because we have that hope in Messiah, because even though there had not arisen a prophet like unto Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, we do understand that there was a prophet like unto Moses who did come on the scene, and that is the Messiah Yeshua. And Messiah Yeshua has told us that there is nothing that has been hidden that it will not be revealed. In verse 12, it says that all these things which Moses wrought in the sight of all Israel, referring, of course, to all the signs that he performed. Because all these things that were performed at the hand of Moses, the splitting of the sea, the plagues, the manna, the water from the rock, etc., they were unprecedented and remain so. I mean, even many of the signs that Yeshua performed, many of them were subtle. Some of them were hard to discern. Miraculous, yes. People being raised from the dead, yes. But other people had been raised from the dead. In other words, there's something to this idea that the things that God used Moses to perform are unprecedented. And again, certainly not taking anything away from what Yeshua did, but the point is that sometimes they were done in secret. Here's the point. These flagrant and very obvious signs that Moses performed in the sight of Israel won't be seen again in that way until the end of days. We have an example of that for us in Revelation chapter 11, verses 3 through 6. Now, as we begin to close, we see that other than Yeshua, other than the Messiah, Moses is probably the one individual in all the history of man who has influenced more societies, more nations, more governments than any other one person, second only to Yeshua, the Messiah. And one of the things in conjunction with this point that rabbis note is that Moses was such a great man and such a great leader that he was willing to shatter the tablets in the sight of Israel. And God ratified that decision. In other words, a great leader has to make very courageous, dramatic decisions at times. And his virtues must be such that he is willing, if it's the right thing to do, to shatter his life's works. In other words, the tablets would represent his life's work, if you will. But when he saw the people reveling around the golden calf, he shattered the tablets, and God ratified that decision because he perceived the people were not worthy to receive the tablets. Another example is Abraham. He's promised Isaac. That's the promised seed. But yet we see that God tells him to take him to the top of Mount Moriah and to offer him as a burnt offering. And that's exactly what Abraham did. And then ultimately, we see this in Yeshua, who says, "Father, if it were possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done." He says, "No man's taking my life. I'm laying my life down." So again, it is to say that Moses is an example of what a true leader should be, and that Moses has influenced generations because he was a great man. But it also records for us that he was the meekest man that walked the earth. He was humble because he was a servant to the Creator. His identity is established in the Creator. And so again, being second only to Yeshua the Messiah, we see that these are the attributes and the characteristics of a true leader. A true leader, according to the Messiah, is someone who is a servant first. And so this seems to be a fitting end to the Torah portions. Because ultimately, the Torah is an instruction booklet written for those whose heart is they want to be a servant to the Creator. And of course, the ultimate example is Yeshua the Messiah, who, by the way, is the emphasis of the Torah. He is the goal of the Torah, Paul writes to us. And so in the last word of the Torah, which is the word Yisrael, the last letter of the Torah being the Lamed of Yisrael, compare that to the first word in the Torah, Bereshit, and the first letter of the Torah, Beit. And here's what we see. That in the beginning, Bereshit, God's purpose was to bring forth a nation called Yisrael who would be his servant. Those who had a heart to serve him. They didn't want to elevate themselves. They abased themselves. He elevated them. And they were to lead others. They were to be a light to the nations by submitting their will to the Creator's will. And through his servant, Moses, he gave Israel the Torah, which they were to in turn take and to preserve and to pass it from generation to generation to be a light to the nations, to show that we are your servants. And then we also see that in that Torah that Moses gave them, or that God gave them through the hand of Moses, ultimately reveals the ultimate servant, and that is Yeshua, and that is the heart of the Torah, the Messiah Yeshua. Interestingly, if you take that last letter, Lamed, of the Torah, and then place it with the first letter of the Torah, Beit, the result is the Hebrew word Lev, which means heart. And so with that, we come to the end of these Torah portions. We come to the end of the Torah. Shalom.
Like what you're hearing? Become a BillCloud Premium Partner to watch or listen to hundreds of hours of teachings and resources on demand. Go to BillCloud.com/subscribe to start watching today.